Hello, and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Rabbi Meir Schweiger discusses Parshat Yitro. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior faculty member of Pardes and serves as the Pardes Mashiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
Thank you, Larry, for the introduction. This week's parasha is Parashat Yitro, the central topic, the Ten Commandments. In last year's podcast, we examined the fifth commandment, honoring one's parents. Today, I would like to follow up and look at the eighth commandment, do not steal. I have attached a source sheet titled Gnevat Da'at, Deception and Fraud. I highly recommend that you download the sheet and follow along. My first reference is the commentary of the Ibn Ezra, the Spanish medieval commentary known for being meticulous to explain the text according to the pshat, the simple meaning. On our verse, do not steal, the Ibn Ezra says, this word also includes a situation of someone who steals the heart of another, as Absalom did. The Ibn Ezra does not explain the text in the simple way that we would normally say, one who steals property, or as the rabbis explained it, one who kidnaps a person, which is a capital offense, parallel to do not kill, do not commit adultery. The Ibn Ezra says, do not steal, includes, not that it means exclusively, but also includes the situation of someone who steals the heart of another. The Ibn Ezra attempts to show the full magnitude of this prohibition, its comprehensive nature. In reference number 3, at the end, there is also the citation of Absalom. And there it says, and Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. Samuel 2, chapter 15, verse 6. Let us begin by looking at what happened with Absalom, or as he is known in Hebrew, Avshalom, the son of David. The chapter begins by speaking about how Avshalom gathers together chariots, horses, men who run before him, is beginning to establish the trappings of a leader. And then we're told how he would get up early in the morning and stand by the gate. And when people would come to present their cases in judgment before the king, he would call out to them, befriend them. Where are you from? What is your name? Tell me, what is your issue? And after hearing them out, he would tell them how correct and true their position is, how just their position is. When people would see him and recognize him as the son of the king and desire to bow down to him, he would grab them, stop them from bowing down as an expression of humility. He would kiss them. The biblical text describes all of these actions as stealing the hearts of the men of Israel. Everything that Avshalom was doing was a facade, a charade, a ploy to be able to win the backing of the people for that moment when he would launch his rebellion against David. Let me begin by saying the model of Avshalom becomes a very important lesson to leaders, to men in public position. How many people vying for office smile, flatter, exhibit profound humility, camaraderie, in order to be able to get the votes to put them in office? Is their seeking support genuine? Do they really care about the people? Do they really want to promote the well-being of the people? Or is everything just a game to be able to promote themselves? The language is very, very interesting. He stole the hearts of the people. I titled my source sheet, Stealing One's Mind. And that, in fact, is the phrase which the rabbis use. You steal one's mind, you deceive them, but very often you steal their mind in order to win over their heart. Avshalom is not just misleading them in terms of who he is, but Avshalom is trying to penetrate their hearts under a false impression. And it seems that he has a track record. He killed his half-brother, who raped his sister, his brother Amnon, who raped Tamar. And he was able to do that because he led him on. Never once did he give him the impression that he was upset, that he was angry, so that in any way he could imagine what was awaiting him. In doing that crime, he deceived his father to convince him to have his brother come with him. I bring this point up because Avshalom is an extreme example of someone who steals the heart of other people, and where that act leads to murder, to bloodshed. His personality goes from stealing, from deceiving, to killing. In the same way, he has no problem manipulating the hearts and minds of people. He has no problem taking their lives. Let us examine another story. Reference number 2. This is the story of Jacob and Laban. We all know how Laban tricked Jacob, manipulated him in every way. And I discussed this in a previous podcast. There is one point where we can actually sympathize with Laban. In Bereshit, chapter 31, verse 20. And Jacob stole the heart of Laban the Aramean by not telling him that he was fleeing. Jacob ran away. When the time came to go, Jacob was not able to go directly to Laban and tell him, straight to his face, that his time was up. He needed to go back. Instead, he waited for an opportune moment, and he ran away. And when Laban discovered what had happened, he chased after Jacob. And in verse 26 says, "What did you do? You stole my heart. You led my daughters away as captives, taken by the sword. Why did you hide from me to flee and steal me? You didn't tell me you were going. I would have sent you away with song and rejoicing, with a drum and lyre." We know that Laban is someone who is deceptive himself. We know that Laban is lying. He would not have sent Jacob away with all the fanfare. He is in such a victim as he makes himself out to be. But it's important to note that the Torah itself passes judgment when it says Jacob stole the heart of Laban. And a verse which is not on your sheet, verse 19, just before that, it says, Rachel stole the trafim which belonged to her father. Here is another example of someone who steals another person's heart. Although we can understand why Jacob did it, and although what is happening here is radically different than the story of Avshalom, Jacob is doing this as a defense mechanism. He needs to get away from Laban. God told him the time had come. He feels incapable of discussing it directly with Laban. He steals his heart, not in terms of trying to manipulate him, to use him, to exploit him, to destroy him. He steals his heart to simply protect himself. And in fact, if I were to go back to what I said earlier, Jacob really did not steal the heart of Laban. He wasn't trying to capture his heart. He stole his mind. He was not upfront. Yet nevertheless, this was seen as a problematic move. I would like to now proceed and look at a number of halachic statements that appear in the Talmud and are later codified, situations that I think are very much relevant to our day-to-day lives. Reference number 3. This is from the Tosefta, material from the period of the Mishnah, parallel to the Mishnah. It says, there are seven types of thieves. The first, and I also translate the worst, is the one who steals the minds of people. And then the Tosefta goes on to give examples. One who urges his friend to be his guest, but does not in his heart want to invite him. One who excessively offers gifts to his friend, knowing that the latter will not accept them. And one who opens up barrels for another that was sold to a shopkeeper. One who reduces the price of measurements. One who lies about weights. Let me begin by saying, what makes stealing the minds of people so terrible? In our scale of values, we would say the worst type of stealing is kidnapping, where you steal the person, literally steal someone's person. It's a capital offense. Next, property. But stealing the mind of a person, there was no damage done. Or, relatively speaking, very little damage. You led somebody on, so what makes it so bad? And I think that the answer lies in the question. The very fact that someone does not see it as being so bad becomes the basis to rationalize it. And when it becomes rationalized, it becomes pervasive in society. Look at the examples which are given in the Tosefta. You urge somebody to be your guest. You go over to somebody, invite them to come for a Shabbat meal. You know fully well that that person will not come. They were invited somewhere else. And then they decline. But you go on and on, urging them, telling them how badly you want them to come. You offer people all kinds of gifts, knowing fully well that they won't accept them. And I think if you look at what's stated in the sheet, one who excessively offers gifts. And if you look at reference number 4 in the Bach, a major commentary on the Tur, a leading halachic authority in the 1600s, commenting on the Tur with respect to the example that we have here, he says it would seem to be that only pleading excessively is forbidden, but asking once or twice out of respect is not forbidden. And so are we accustomed to do. The Bach is making a very, very important distinction. There may be all kinds of situations where we might not be thrilled or desiring to invite somebody to our home. Yet nevertheless, we feel guilty. We feel perhaps obligated to do so. And so we ask them. We ask them, as he says, out of respect, out of courtesy, out of a feeling of perhaps this would be the right thing to do. And the Bach says, if you invite somebody, even if your heart is not whole with that move, that's okay. And that's something that people do all the time, which is legitimate. The problem arises when I'm excessive, when I flatter someone, when I try to make them think how much I value them when it's a lie. There are nuances. And the reason I want them to think how much I value them is because I want them to think what a great guy I am, a tzaddik. That is the problem of stealing one's mind, one's heart. The line sometimes may be blurry, subtle. And this is a question that a person has to always ask himself. What's motivating me? Why am I doing this? Am I inviting this person because I feel that this is the right thing to do? Is it out of a sense of obligation? That still may be legitimate. But am I inviting them where I'm sure that they will refuse? Where the only purpose to do that is in order to gain from it. I'm not doing it for them, I'm doing it for me. I'll look well. How about another example, which I think happens quite often? I am about to make a wedding. I invite people who I know will never come. How do I know that? They live far away. They're elderly. They're going on vacation. Why do I invite them? Because I also know that these are people who are very generous, whenever they're invited somewhere, always give a very nice gift to the couple. I'm inviting them not because I really want them to come. I know they're not going to come. I'm inviting them because I want to get their present. I know fully well that there are situations where there are people who, if they're not invited, will be insulted. And so therefore, one has to ask themselves the question, when I invite somebody to the wedding, knowing they won't come, am I inviting them because I want them to feel good? I want them to feel they're relatives of mine who would be deeply hurt and insulted if I didn't send them an invitation, who would feel that I have cut them off from the family. And I do it as a way of showing them, I really wish you could come, even though I know you won't. Or am I doing it because I really don't want them to come, but I know they'll send me a nice present? A person needs to be very, very honest with themselves. What is motivating me? Am I really thinking of that person, or am I thinking of myself? Let's look at reference number 5. A Mishnah from Baba Metzia. Mishnah 10. Just as there is wronging in buying and selling, so is there wronging in words. One may not say to him, how much does this item cost, when he has no intent to buy? How many times do people walk into stores which they know in advance are overpriced, where they shop around so that this way they can ascertain the high price? Perhaps this way they can get all kinds of information so that they will better be equipped to go buy in the store around the corner, or perhaps on the internet. To what degree is it that I walk into a store and I lead somebody on, spend an hour with them, ask them loads of questions, knowing fully well that there is no way in the world that I could possibly buy from them? And the flip side, what does it mean to have somebody who walks into a store who's sincerely interested in purchasing something, and to be accosted by the seller, who really gives them a sales pitch, who convinces them absolutely to buy something which they have no use for, who, when they put on that dress or that suit, tells them how beautiful they look, stunning, when it's all a lie, who is stealing their heart in order to get their money? When we read the situations described in the Tosefta or the Mishnah or the Talmud, it is fascinating to see how human nature has not changed in 2,000 years. Look at Mishnah number 11. One may not mix together fruits with fruits, even if both are new. And it goes without saying new with old. If I could give you an analogy, I walk into a store and say, I'd like to have Coca-Cola. And then the seller gives me RC Cola, Pepsi Cola. And basically his attitude is, I'm giving you cola. What difference does it make if you get Coca-Cola or Pepsi Cola? It's all the same. It's cola. And I know that there will be people who will argue, but there are differences in the quality. But hypothetically, what if I have a situation where I walk into a store and ask for a certain product, which is a brand name, and I'm given another product, which is generic, which is the same quality, but if I were told that it's generic, I would never buy it. So the seller puts a label on of the brand name. I'm not being cheated in terms of the quality. I'm not being cheated in terms of the price which I'm paying. But I am being cheated in terms of not knowing what I'm really getting. That's gnevat daat. I was misled. And even if in some objective scheme, it may not matter, because I got the product for the price, what matters is my person was violated. I go back to the example of Lavan. Even Lavan was violated as a person when Jacob was not upfront with him. Let us look a little further. Reference number 7. Abaye said, a scholar must clarify his credentials if an individual is knowledgeable in one tractate, and he goes to a place in which people want to honor him because they think he knows two tractates, he is required to correct their false impression and tell them, I know only one tractate. In a modern situation, this would be analogous to someone who's giving a lecture, who is presented before the audience as rabbi, doctor, professor, but does not have the appropriate credentials. It may very well be that the person is knowledgeable. It may very well be that given the knowledge which they have, or whatever credentials that they have, that they deserve to be honored. Yet nevertheless, it may very well be that the honor shown them is in excess of the credentials which they actually have. And therefore, it is very important for that person to set the record straight, so that in no way do people have a misimpression. Having said that, let's go back to reference number 6. Mar Zutra, the son of Rav Nachman, is going from Sikara to Mechoza. While Rava and Rav Safra were going to Sikara, they met each other. Thinking that they had come to meet him, he said, why did the rabbis trouble themselves to come so far to meet me? And Rav Safra replied, we did not know that the master was coming. But had we known, we would have troubled ourselves even more. And Rava said, I imagine, on the side, to Rav Safra, why did you speak that way to him? You have upset him. And he replied, but we would be deceiving him otherwise. No, he replied, he would be deceiving himself. The story is fascinating. And if I had to paraphrase it into a modern context, I show up to somebody's house because I just happen to stop by. And it so happens, they're having a birthday party. And they're excited to see me. And they say, wow, isn't it unbelievable? I can't believe that you made that effort to come to my birthday party. What do I say to them? Do I say to them, well, I really wasn't coming to the party. I just happened to stop by. Or do I tell them, of course I would never miss your birthday party. It seems to be from this text that if they come to a conclusion on their own, not one that you actually created, you don't have to correct the misimpression. So how does this reference jive with the previous one? It seems to be from later rabbinic discussion that a distinction is made between situations where people reach conclusions that would be reasonable from the context versus a situation where they've really exaggerated and where you need to set the record straight. If I come to a place where I know that people are very, very careful about the titles which are given and the honor shown accordingly, if they come to certain conclusions, I have to set the record straight. Because it might very well be that the conclusions that they came to were reasonable and I shouldn't lead them on. But there are some times when people read into things that you do something which wasn't at all there. And in the example that I gave, it could be I had absolutely no intention of leading the person on by stopping by their house. They now see me. They're so excited that I came to their birthday party. Why upset them? As Rav Safra said to Rava, as Rava said to him, to Rav Safra, all of these examples require judgment calls, require that a person ask themselves, am I misleading them? Am I taking advantage of them? Am I doing it in order to be able to pump myself up? Or am I maybe going along with their misimpression because I don't want to upset them? I don't want to ruin their party. I want them to really feel good, to think that there are people who really care about them. How many times have people been in situations where there are people who feel very lonely, cut off, and where you sit down and just engage them in some very simple conversation? And when they feel that you are taking such an interest in them, when you're really not, and feel so good about it. Why dash them? Why upset them? Let them feel good. Sometimes it could become even more complicated, because then perhaps they'll draw all kinds of conclusions. A classic example of this would be dating, where sometimes being nice to someone might be misinterpreted that you're in love with them, you cherish them. These are not easy situations with easy answers. Let me conclude with a statement from Maimonides, reference number 9. It is forbidden for someone to conduct himself with smooth and seductive speech. And here is a very important line. There should not be a discrepancy between one's heart and mouth. Rather, one's inside should correlate to his outside, so that what is in his heart should be the same as that which is in his mouth. It is forbidden to deceive people, even Gentiles. And the example which is taken from the Talmud, one should not sell a Gentile meat or shoes from a dead animal instead of meat or shoes from a ritually slaughtered animal. And one could come along and say, but he's a Gentile, he's a non-Jew. What difference does it make if I tell him this meat is kosher or not kosher? He doesn't have to eat kosher meat. But how many situations are there of non-Jews who go to kosher restaurants, who somehow feel that the quality of the meat, the sanitary conditions, are superior in a kosher framework? So that to sell them something as kosher when it's not kosher is misleading. It's dehumanizing. And if I skip to the very last line of Maimonides, rather, one should have true speech, upright spirit, and a pure heart. I would like to end on this note. There are many laws that have to do with interpersonal relations, where the bottom line is, what is in your heart? What is really motivating you? Where the bottom line is, when you act, are you doing this for the other, to promote them? Are you thinking of their well-being? Or are you simply using somebody to promote yourself? The rabbis in a number of places in the Talmud see stealing as being a horrific sin. This was the sin of the people of stone. According to the rabbis, this was the sin of the generation of the flood. This was the basis for the destruction of the world. Stealing one's heart may seem to be innocuous. And certainly, there are quite a few examples where it doesn't seem to be that anything major comes of it. But the danger is the habit, is the pervasive nature of it. The idea that we basically create a modus operandi of where we look at the world as existing for our fulfillment, fulfillment in the negative sense, where it's I am first, I am number one, and where anything and everything can be compromised in order to promote me. The Torah sets up very, very high standards. If I go back to how we began, what the Ibn Ezra says is pshat, because when the Torah said lo tignov, it did not qualify it. It is stated as an absolute. Do not steal, period. Anything which can be viewed as stealing, which is taking away from someone else, which is arrogating to ourselves something which we're not entitled to, that is stealing. It is important to realize that in the end, people are judged by the little things. That is what separates the righteous from the evil, the subtleties. May we always follow the path of the righteous, or in the words of Maimonides, have true speech and a pure heart. Shabbat shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated. Please send your emails to podcast@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.